It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at what prompted the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago and what's known about the documents they found there. First, a lot of people quit their jobs during the pandemic, and for people who got new jobs, the competitive labor market meant a lot of them came back with a bigger paycheck. In some cases, that created pay gaps between new hires and more senior workers at the same organization who never left their jobs. Our next guest says some companies are taking steps to even out those gaps in pay. Others are hoping it just kind of goes under the radar. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We want to hear your job history over the last couple of years. Did you seek a new job? Did you leave a job behind? Did you stay with the same kind of profession or start something totally new? Were you able to get more money by leaving? Or if you stayed instead of going, how did things work out for you? Call 800-642-1234. If you're in the business of hiring people, what are things like? Easy? Difficult? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Aki Ito is a senior correspondent at Business Insider. She covers the economy, the labor market, and the workplace. Aki, welcome back.
Hi, great to be with you.
Well, can you talk about the kind of pay disparities between the movers and the stayers? You wrote about this, it's been a couple few months now, earlier this summer.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, basically what's happening is that the job market was so hot over this past year and a half, that companies had to give out these crazy salaries in order to attract new candidates to their companies. And as a result, that created this really deep divide between the people who are just joining the company and people who've been around for years. There's one company called Labor IQ. They're a compensation data provider that estimated that this gap is about 7% right now, which is quite large. I mean, that's, you know, on the order of tens of thousands of dollars for certain positions. And that gap is even higher in certain tech roles, as large as 20%.
Now, I've been in the position, you know, when I see an ad from my phone provider, cable provider, they're offering this great deal for new customers. And I think, well, wait, what about me? Are we getting a sense that these employees who are staying and seeing these other people get sweet deals, is there like resentment out there in the workplace?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what about me is exactly what a lot of employees are thinking. You know, these employees who've been around for years, they stuck around through the good times and the bad. They've showed a tremendous amount of loyalty to their employers. And what do they get in, you know, in response to that? They're actually getting underpaid compared to the people who are just joining the company.
Have you seen companies try to account for that and say, hey, maybe it'll be cheaper to keep people?
Well, I think the smart companies are. They have realized that it's better to just give everybody an around the board raise than it is to, you know, lose everybody and then have to recruit new employees all over again. That's an incredibly expensive process. But even if, you know, that's a long-term cheaper solution, obviously companies have very tight budgets right now. They might not be able to afford that. And so they're trying other things to try to retain their existing employees as well.
Yeah, what other kind of strategies?
I think some are like improving the benefits that they're giving employees. Some are giving more generous work from home privileges. Others might be giving not, you know, necessarily a raise of the base salary, but a one-time bonus. I've seen a lot of that.
Talking to Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider, looking at the great resignation during the pandemic. A lot of people switched jobs there. And what happens with pay? And do we have new people at a place getting paid more than the ones who stuck around? A lot of different stuff going on here. You can join in with maybe your own story if you've switched jobs along the way. 800-642-1234. If you're an employer, what have things been like trying to lure recruits, trying to keep the people you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Christine is with us in Wauwatosa. Christine, hi.
Hey, hi. So I just wanted to put my two cents worth in. I was a substitute teacher during the pandemic. And of course, once everything went virtual, there was no need for substitute teachers in our school district. So I took a job at Amazon, and I ended up actually enjoying my job. I didn't like the hours that, you know, but it was something to do and to help the family income. And that's it. Of course, once school started back up, I couldn't do both. So I had to make a choice, and I chose to go back working for the school district. And that's it.
Christine, thanks for sharing that. Aki, I think when it comes to hiring people, as in so many things, a lot of employers are competing with Amazon in particular and their warehouse jobs that had a boost during the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear this in every industry, you know, from hospitals. They have a huge shortage of nurses and other professionals because in some cases, these Amazon warehouses pay more than these hospitals. I've certainly heard about it with teachers. I've heard about it in restaurants and in hotels. Absolutely. I mean, Amazon is hoovering everybody up. And as a result, the, you know, entire economy is having to compete with that if they can by offering higher wages as well.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Maggie joins us next in Madison. Maggie, hello.
Hey. So I was just curious because I feel like I see a lot of stores closing early because of not having enough employees. There's all of these shortages. But my understanding is that unemployment is also at an all-time low. So how does that like math work out? If everyone is working, but we have all of these open positions, kind of what causes that gap?
Right. So unemployment is like, basically, I think people call it a labor shortage in some sectors, Aki. Low unemployment, lots of openings, not enough people to apply for those jobs in some cases.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the big mysteries of our time. Economists have been puzzling over this for the last 2 years, and I don't think anyone has quite figured out why. There's certainly some factors that relate to COVID. Some parents dropped out of the workforce and they feel like they're not ready to come back yet just because their childcare situation isn't totally steady with, you know, these new variants still floating around. In other cases, a lot of older workers retired. And so that reduces the number of people who are available to work as well. But yeah, certainly there is still a huge labor shortage right now. That's one of the reasons why the unemployment rate is so low. And it's because of the shortage that the labor market is so hot as a result. You know, all these companies are competing for a very small pool of available workers.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Aki, you also wrote about where people are working, remote work, and an interesting trend. Some of the high cost of living cities, you know, San Francisco, other places like that, you know, usually you get paid more if you work there because you got to pay more to live there. You found that some companies who are paying people to work remotely are paying them more, and you name drop cities, including Milwaukee. What's going on?
Yeah, so basically, because of the widespread availability of remote positions, companies can now recruit employees not just in the big cities that they're based, let's say San Francisco or New York City, but also from all across the country. And that means that there are a lot more employers competing for employees in cities like Milwaukee compared to before. And as a result, the employees in Milwaukee are commanding a much higher salary than they used to. Milwaukee is actually one of the cities where we've seen the biggest salary increases for white collar professionals across the country. It was number three in the country, a 20% increase since 2019, which is incredible.
We're talking to Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider, who covers the economy, labor market, and workplaces. She's with us today to talk about a gap in pay between new hires and veteran employees that's cropped up in many companies during the Great Resignation and other issues related to the job market these days. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. At your workplace, have you seen this having to pay more to bring new people in? If you're one of the people who's already there, are you worried that the new folks are getting paid more than you are? Have you switched jobs or made a point of staying put over the course of the pandemic if you hire people? Can you talk about the difficulties you're facing bringing staff on board, or have you found a solution? You're doing fine. You're finding the people you need. Either way, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the pandemic, workplace, the great resignation, how there's some pay disparities in places between new recruits and senior employees who've been around a company longer. Aki Ito is with us from Business Insider. Still time for your call, your story, maybe your experience at 800-642-1234. Did you change jobs? Did you change professions? Did you get more money, or are you just happier in the new place? Have you stuck with the place you're in? If you hire people, are you finding people? And what do you think of all this? Are you looking for work and having trouble finding it? That story's out there too. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Jack is with us in Green Bay. Jack, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
The reason I'm calling, thanks for taking my call. I have some friends and relatives who went back to school during the pandemic, got their associate degrees in business, and would apply for jobs around the area in Green Bay, get interviews, and then the employer didn't even have the courtesy of calling them to say they didn't get the position, or if they didn't get the position, why they didn't get the position. Their employers have been just terrible in following up with letting applicants know that they're not getting the job or what the reason is. And if they call back to the employer won't take their call.
Jack, thanks a lot for sharing that. Aki, this isn't the first time I've heard things like that. And we hear about potential employees ghosting potential employers. Jack says sometimes going the other way, too.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this has been the case for a long time. HR professionals call this the candidate experience, how the interviewing process feels on the candidate side. And I think that's come back to haunt certain companies during the Great Resignation, when the labor market has been so hot, because these companies that mistreated candidates in the past, new candidates don't want to go work for them anymore. I heard a lot of stories over this past year where companies were shortening the interviewing process. I'm sure everyone has heard of those companies that, you know, make you interview 10 different times and just so time consuming and labor intensive. A lot of companies try to shorten that process, make it easier for candidates as part of one way that they were trying to woo more workers to come work for them.
Jack, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Pat joins us next in Milwaukee. Pat, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about my wife and I are a small business, a restaurant in the neighborhood of River West. And, the getting through COVID was crazy. We never worked so hard to lose money. But, you know, there was a future that if we keep working, we'll be ready for business when COVID clears up. Anyways, the hiring issue, or like, you know, why people seem to be taking more time to think about what you're doing. At first it was frustrating, and maybe it still is, I guess, but I realized it gave people a chance, you know, like hopping off this crazy treadmill, especially Americans seem to be on with working and working, and figuring out what they're going to dedicate their time to. Is it what's worth it, and how we need more money. And we're a small business. We've always been, for pre-owning a business, behind a $15 minimum at the start, and then let's, you know, go from there. So it was I think it's been a, you know, it's a good thing. It's kind of an odd moment that everyone was given.
Pat, thanks a lot for sharing that. That's interesting, Aki. Pat, you know, in some cases it makes it harder to hire people, but he's glad that people are taking the time to think about what they want to do with their careers. Is that something you think a lot of people are doing?
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons why the national quit rate has been so high over this past year. It's why we're all calling it the Great Resignation. You know, it's not just because the labor market is hot and as a result, there are more opportunities to switch jobs. It's also because the pandemic gave people time to think and really consider what they want to do with the rest of their lives. Some of that was about their personal lives, but some of that was also about their work. And I think we are now starting to see the people who took some time off, who took that time to really, you know, figure out what they want to do in the future. start to, you know, actually start those new jobs. Maybe they went back to school, or maybe they started a whole new career. And I think that's really exciting.
Pat, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Talking to Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider, looking at the latest from the Great Resignation, what's happening at workplaces around the country. Are people still switching jobs? Are you? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know if you stayed or went from the job you had, say, coming into 2020. Let us know what it's like to try to hire people in 2022. Call 800-642-1234. Trisha from Menominee shared a story. Called in to say she worked for the Department of Corrections for 17 years, quit during the pandemic, started working in a warehouse and loves it. Makes more money and has a lot less stress. You could share your story at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Aki, now here we are, summer of 2022. Is there a sense that there's still that that premium for switching jobs? You recently looked, I think, in particular at the tech industry to see if people are still making bank by leaving and signing on somewhere else.
I think there definitely is. When you look at all of the labor market data, it's very clear that the job market is still incredibly hot. But it does feel like we're coming to a plateau at this point. The level of job openings has stopped increasing. The share of people who are quitting their jobs, that's leveled out as well. So we probably are headed for some kind of slowdown over the next few months. That is what some of the broader indicators suggest. At the same time, you know, with inflation, for example, workers are still asking for big raises, and often they're getting them. And the best way to get a raise is still to switch to a new job.
And in the tech industry in particular, I mean, sometimes we hear some big name companies are saying, okay, we're going to stop hiring people, some of them in some cases, like some of the big name companies you heard of, cutting some jobs. You dug deeper into the technology industry. Is this an across the board dial back of jobs in technology?
It so far it doesn't seem to be. I think it's still relatively limited to a small portion of employers. There's certainly a lot of employers that have implemented hiring freezes or have actually gone ahead and done a round of layoffs. But there are plenty of other employers, too, that are using this opportunity to hire the workers that they couldn't when the labor market was so hot over this past year that they just couldn't attract enough new candidates. So I think it's going both ways. That said, if there's any sector in the economy that is probably experiencing a job market slowdown, it probably would be in tech, just because that's the industry where we're seeing the biggest slowdowns in corporate earnings. And that's putting pressure on companies to really try to cut down on costs.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us now in Star Lake. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi. I think it's a great program. I've thought a lot about this Great Resignation. I read a book some years ago. In fact, I sent it to my son who was doing his doctorate. It was called Shop Class as Soul Craft. I don't know if you knew it. It was kind of a book that got a real buzz when it came out. Mm-hmm. A fellow who had gotten his doctorate at the University of Chicago, went to a think tank, supposedly the perfect job, realized he was totally unhappy, and he wound up opening a motorcycle repair business in Richmond. And he just really started looking at how we direct so many young people into these kinds of, managerial kind of roles or high tech, and that the trades themselves can be a very satisfying life and also financially a good life anymore because they're in such high demand. And I think that some of the resignation of the young people I know, my kids' age, that are in their late 20s and 30s, a lot of it is they're just walking away from jobs that are just boring as can be. And it's not just the money. You know, they're looking for something that has an inherent satisfaction. And you build or fix something, and particularly, for men, but I think probably for women, it's just a more satisfying experience.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, that rung a bell. I looked in our archives. Matthew Crawford's the author of that book. He was on Central Time back in 2015, a few years back. But you could check that out in our archives. Again, that idea, Aki, of some people, Joe says people leaving their jobs because they're not satisfying, they're boring, he says, and looking for something more fulfilling. Is that going on? Is that something you think might continue if so?
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting trend. I mean, we spend so much of our lives at work. whether we do it from home or whether we're in the office. So we might as well do something that we enjoy if we can afford that. I think one of the other interesting trends, though, over these past 2.5 years is that some people are deciding that they don't need to love their jobs as well. You might have heard of the term hustle culture, and some people are deciding that, they don't necessarily need to be doing something that, that they're totally passionate about in order to earn a living. So I think it goes both ways. Some people are looking for jobs that are more fulfilling, and other people are trying to find fulfillment outside of work altogether.
Thanks again for that call. And just less than a minute now, Aki, I know you always are watching for the next trend in work. What are you watching for next?
Oh, so much. I mean, I think that the big thing right now is how the labor market shapes up. Over these next few months with the economic slowdown, how big, if there will be a recession, and if there will be a recession, how big it'll be, how much it'll affect people's job prospects. That's probably the biggest story I'm going to be following.
Aki, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider, where she covers the economy, the labor market, and workplaces. She was with us today to talk about pay disparities between people who've gotten new jobs during the Great Resignation and the workers who've decided to stay put, and other big issues going on in American workplaces now. You can still share your story of staying in a job, leaving a job, hiring people for jobs. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page what's going on in your workplace. Now, the FBI searched Mar-a-Lago last week. They had a warrant to search the Florida home of former President Trump for a trove of classified documents that belong to the National Archives. The list of documents taken under that warrant, which was made public by Attorney General Merrick Garland, included 4 sets of top-secret documents and 7 other sets of information at different levels of classification. We're talking about the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago, laws about classified information and presidential record-keeping, and the ways that search warrants are issued and executed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago? What do you want to know that you don't know now? Do you have questions about how these kind of searches might be authorized and undertaken? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Cammie Chavis is a professor of law and director of the Center for Criminal Justice Policy and Reform at William & Mary Law School. She is also a former federal prosecutor. Cammie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with some nuts and bolts here. What needs to happen in order for law enforcement to get this kind of search warrant in the first place?
Yes. So what I think is really interesting is, you know, a lot of people want to make distinctions. This is a former president and these are classified documents. But the FBI is a federal law enforcement agency, and there are rules that govern all kinds of searches. And so there are 3 laws that the search warrant has implicated. But what we know is that you have to have probable cause that a crime has been committed and that there's a reasonable likelihood that evidence of that crime will be found in the particular space specified by the warrant. This comes directly from our Constitution that you cannot issue a warrant without probable cause. So that tells us a lot about the information that would have been contained within the affidavit for the judge to sign off on this warrant.
Now, what we have in terms of rock solid information here is that warrant that's been released and the list of material removed, vague in some cases, but with some indications of the kind of classification levels of the documents removed. From what you see there, what do you think of that initial case that there was probable cause here? It seems like the FBI went in and found what the warrant said they were looking for.
Yes. There have been a number of news media outlets, Associated Press and others, that are asking the court to unseal the underlying affidavit. So what was easily made public, Merrick Garland released the information, so we know the kinds of documents that were retrieved. But what we don't know right now is the information that led up to that. That is under the court has sealed that information. And DOJ at present has opposed, and it makes sense that they would oppose unsealing that affidavit. They've said, and this is a quote, this is a roadmap to their investigation. And it would be really, in any circumstance, unusual to unseal that affidavit. There's, again, giving information about witnesses and other evidence that the government may have that might jeopardize the investigation before things actually progress.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that affidavit. So this is the material the FBI goes to. I think it's called a magistrate judge says, here's why, here's the information we have that says we have probable cause to go do this. This is why we want you to issue this warrant. Is this something that that material is ever released in the midst of an investigation?
It's, as I said, it would be highly unusual for it to be released. Of course, if let's say in this case, if any defendant, if Donald Trump were to become a defendant and then had to and was charged or indicted with these particular crimes and there was a trial, there would be discovery in that. And the defendant would certainly be privy to information there. But right now, it's early in the investigation. And again, you're trying to get these documents to see if you even have a crime that's been committed.
Now, this we've been talking sort of generically about search warrants. Now, this is a former president of the United States. Arguments from media organizations wanting this affidavit unsealed have said, this is a big deal. This is an unusual circumstance where a former president is being investigated. Some Republican members of Congress have said this too, including two from Wisconsin. We should unseal that affidavit because we really want to make sure that a current administration isn't unfairly targeting a previous administration. Do you think there's a case to be made that this is special and might work a little differently in this case?
Well, I think it's, of course, the Department of Justice would be concerned about jeopardizing this investigation or any other investigation. And while I'm certainly sympathetic to this, absolutely is a case of great public interest, but there are also, I think, countervailing considerations. And to that, you know, again, if DOJ has the opportunity to present evidence to a grand jury and either someone is indicted or not, you know, that is the process that this would go through. And even again, there's quite a bit of secrecy related to grand jury. To the grand jury for similar reasons. We're worried about witness tampering, and we're worried about jeopardizing an investigation. I think that it's fair. Of course, the public wants to know. I think it's also a very sad moment in our history where we really don't trust on a lot of people on kind of either side of the political spectrum don't trust whatever processes are in place, but these laws and the processes are in place for a reason, and that's to preserve the integrity of the institution and of our criminal justice system.
Talking to Cami Chavis, law professor, director of the Center for Criminal Justice Policy and Reform at William & Mary Law School, also former federal prosecutor, looking at the FBI executing a search warrant last week at Mar-a-Lago, former President Trump's home in Florida. You can join in with your thoughts or maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Greg is with us in Madison. Greg, hello.
Hi. So my comment or question is, what could he possibly do with documents of this sort? And that would maybe lead to an answer as to why he had them. You know, the idea that he's home working late at night just doesn't really fly. His version of work was watching TV and tweeting. So I wonder what he really wanted to do with these documents.
Greg, thanks for the question. Cami, I assume that's part of the question in this investigation. A, what did he have? Why did he have it? What was he going to do with it? Do you have some thoughts on what that investigation would look like?
Yeah. Well, you know, at this point, all the information that we had, and we have quite a bit in terms of thinking about those, the three crimes or the three federal laws that were implicated, one of them being the Presidential Records Act and the other being the Espionage Act. So if I am a prosecutor and I'm looking at those laws, what we're thinking about is not whether necessarily what the president may have intended to do with those, that there may be other federal laws and other evidence that would establish a crime, but simply retaining under the Presidential Records Act, simply retaining those documents and not giving them to the National Archives, the federal law that makes that a crime. This is, you know, for the first couple hundred years of our country, presidents were able to take their documents home. But when Richard Nixon decided, so after they were not in office anymore, they were ready to pack up their things, they could go to their home. But President Nixon had some thoughts about what he wanted to do and just destroying certain evidence. And so this law was passed in 1978 in part in response to that. So again, if we're looking at the letter of that, you know, of that statute, because I think there are a lot of crimes that people, a lot of bad things that people may think that Donald Trump was doing with this, but really simply by not giving the records over to the National Archives when they've requested them, that is the criminal act there. And then the Espionage Act, it's very important that we safeguard documents with, you know, that are top secret, and some of the ones classified here, top secret compartmented, things that could be, and the language is, if uncovered and made public, could be exceptionally grave. That's the language, exceptionally grave consequences for U.S. interests. We want to deter people from doing that. We want to encourage people to treat those documents in a certain manner. And so that's why that law exists. And that's the other law that's one of the other laws that has been mentioned. So we can think about all the interesting things that someone might do with those documents, but he hasn't been accused of that, that we know.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the FBI search and seizure of a variety of documents, including some classified material at Mar-a-Lago. Cami Chavis is with us, professor of law, director of the Center for Criminal Justice and Policy and Reform at William & Mary Law School, former federal prosecutor. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this search? What do we not know that you want to know? What do you think of this idea that some media organizations are promoting and some Republicans in Congress that the affidavit, the material that led to the issuing of the search warrant, should also be revealed to the public? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago and rules about search warrants and classified documents with former prosecutor Cami Chavis, now a professor of law, director of the Center for Criminal Justice Policy and Reform at William & Mary Law School. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Let's go back to your calls now. Jacob is with us in Madison. Jacob, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just a little bit astounded as to how he actually was successful in arranging to get boxes and boxes and boxes of documents shipped to Mar-a-Lago when nobody was aware of this. Who else participated in helping him get this stuff shipped? He's a con artist. He's got a good part of the American public conned, and I just don't. I don't understand or accept this kind of behavior from a former president who is now a private citizen.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Cami, what do you think?
You know, I think that the caller brings up a really good point. I always, especially tell my students, as somebody who's been, you know, he has not yet been accused of a crime. We just have the search warrant, right? And there's just this information. But if he ends up being indicted for these crimes, I doubt seriously that it would just be the president alone, because of course, and it with other crimes, you have to have, you know, an accomplice, right? Sometimes in order to make sure that this all goes according to plan. So I think that Jacob is right, that there could be multiple people, and they would have to be pretty high level people who, in my opinion, you know, should have known better. And again, even if the documents were correctly shipped to, you know, to the president to have him review while he's at Mar-a-Lago, then why weren't they returned? That is a question. And there should be very specific protocols when we're talking about the certain levels of documents that we are talking about, protocols for sending them out, receiving them back in, controls as to who is able to see them and who is not. And so somewhere along the way, it really does seem, if true, that some of those protocols have been breached. So I think that we would be not only looking at the individuals who could be accomplices in this, but we really need to investigate, as Jacob said, how did this happen in the first place?
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Kurt joins us now in Milton. Kurt, hi.
Hello to you.
What did you want to bring up, Kurt?
Well, I'm a retired military officer with over 30 years in the defense community and military, handling way above top secret level information. And we do that in a facility called a SCIF, a Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility. And there are strict rules and things for that. But I had, you know, in the handling of it and all of those things. But I had heard that there was a SCIF in Mar-a-Lago. And, you know, that kind of changes everything if it was an approved facility to have very beyond top secret information. The other thing I'd like to know is, you know, in the handling of it and all of that would be all taken care of through proper channels if he indeed had a SCIF. So I'd like to know if that's the case. And I'd also like to know, do they have classified material or SCIFs at other presidential libraries?
Kurt, thanks for the call. My understanding, I read up on this a little, Cammie, my understanding was there was a SCIF in Mar-a-Lago during the Trump presidency. It is now no longer considered an active SCIF facility for that at this point now. But Kurt sees, you know, if it's handled properly, says it's maybe a game changer. What do you think?
Yes, I mean, I think that's true. And as I said earlier, if you know, if that is where the president was spending a lot of time and needed to have access to documents, that would make sense. But there, again, there would be protocols. What's interesting here, particularly when we look at the Espionage Act and the Presidential Records Act, it seems to relate not to things that were happening during his presidency, but the fact that the National Archives requested these documents after he was no longer president. And again, and indeed received, I think, something like 15 boxes back in January. And so there seemed to be an incomplete transferal back to the National Archives. So I think that is where if there's a criminal liability, where that would come in.
Thanks for that call, Kurt. We'll go now to Danny with us in Beloit. Danny, hello.
Hello. Yes, I had a question. I was wondering if with the DOJ or the FBI, when they took an inventory and they carried everything out of the house, if Trump's attorneys wasn't available to be able to document everything, doesn't it open a Pandora's box to where pretty much anything could be stated that was in there?
Danny, thanks for the call. That's interesting, Cammie. Usually when a search warrant is executed, does the person receiving the search or their legal representation usually get to tag along and observe what's being removed?
No, and I think that, again, what I think is so interesting about this search, we're talking about potentially, as I mentioned, information that could be exceptionally grave, have exceptionally grave consequences to U.S. interests, right? There are every day in this country, search warrants that are executed. We're all very familiar with the no-knock warrants and certain types of drug raids and things like that. People do not get to tag along, and usually you are asked to kind of step aside. What you do get, and what the law does say that you should get, and that is a receipt for things that were taken out of the office. Out of the area to be searched. And so I think that if we take some of the arguments that we're hearing, and I've always been, I am a critic of government overreach in certain types of criminal activity, but it's really interesting that we don't hear those same arguments when we're talking about low-level other types of crime. Drug crimes is one thing I'm thinking about. This warrant, this situation was there was lots of notice. We know that the National Archives was looking for this information. We know they requested it multiple times, and we know that that their agents came to the house with a search warrant, and they did knock and announce themselves, and they went through the search process. So again, I think that the criticisms that are being levied against this are valid. There's a lot of distrust in many communities about law enforcement. But if we are to believe that the FBI would have planted these documents, then do we believe that every single person who's arrested for drugs or other type of contraband that law enforcement is planting it there? I just the equivalency I think is really interesting here. Argument. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Danny. Time for one more quick call with Brent in Waukesha. Brent, hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question is kind of along the same lines. As far as, you know, with a search warrant, I always thought that it was, you know, to prove a crime has been committed, not to search for a possible crime that, you know, you're searching for the crime, but you're proving that it's already happened. And in this case, we've said many times the crime hasn't happened yet. We're just trying to see if it did happen.
Gotcha. Brent, thanks for the call. That brings us back to where we started and this concept of probable cause, Cammie. And in fact, that doesn't mean a crime has been committed. It means there's a probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's right. There's probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and that evidence of that crime can be found at the location, reasonably likely to be found at the location to be searched. And I think it's very important here because when we're talking about what crime, we're not talking about whether this person has given government secrets away. That's not what the Presidential Records Act says, and that's not what the espionage says. Both of those acts are really talking about how evidence is handled. You are not supposed to conceal. That is language from the Presidential Records Act. Conceal or destroy presidential records, things that were created by the president in his duties, in his formal duties as president, or by his staff.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Cammie Chavis from William & Mary Law School. She joined us for a look at classified document laws and the process of search warrants in the wake of the FBI search of former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago home last week.